Greek science did not suffer the suppression that occurred with the conversion of Constantine. The academies were not closed. The Hermetic knowledge was not repressed. Conversely, the empire was stronger and was able to repel the barbarian invasions of the 2nd to the 5th century. And mathematics, which had halted in our world at Diophantus, proceeded through his disciple Hypatia to develop a calculus by AD 370, so that the millennium of Christian stasis that occurred in our world did not occur in that world. And as time passed and engineering advances occurred, by around 850, they had ships which were able to cross the Atlantic Ocean, and they encountered the Mayan civilization reaching its fullest flower in Guatemala and on the Yucatan Peninsula. And in fact, in this vision, I saw the Roman Emperor Cosmodorus V make a pilgrimage to Tikal in 920 to be present at the coronation of a king at the end of Bakhtun 8. Anyway, this Greco-Roman imperial culture immediately recognized the genius of the Mayans in mathematics and astronomy, and Europe was transformed into an amalgamation, a Greco-Mayan civilization with the... So let me see... And this civilization continued to develop. Now, one of the influences which the Mayans brought into Europe around the year 950 was their extremely sophisticated psychopharmacopoeia and shamanism. And this mated with Neoplatonism and Hermeticism, so that rather than science developing as it developed in our world, a kind of magical psychopharmacolytic technology of thought and understanding was what was developed over the centuries. And then in later centuries before it happened in our world, they contacted the Orient, and the Sung, the dynastic influence of the Sung, poured itself into the creation of a global civilization, such that by around 1200 AD, they were able to land on the moon and create a cybernetic global civilization similar to the kind we have now. They continued evolving with all this psychotronic and shamanically derived, and now, by this time, you can imagine it was an unbelievably exotic and alien civilization compared to our own. The fruits of their psychedelic and psychoanalytic investigations into higher space was the discovery of our world. They found out what had happened. They figured it out by studying dreams and by making deep journeys into the psychedelic space. They were able to discover our sleeping unconscious with its repository of the legacy of the Christian centuries under the reign of this demiurgic ideology. And they conceived of the notion of saving us. And it has to do with this whole thing about the UFOs and influence in dreams and astral traveling, and the other side is actually the manifestation of this bizarre Greco-Mayan postmodern starfaring civilization trying to reach across the dimensions to save us from the momentum of our history by making us aware of, first of all, their existence, and also their technology, which is evolving toward a point where I think around the Mayan millennium, around 2012, the time island will be, we will flow past the time island, and the two time streams will be rejoined, and we will make peace with this civilization, which is now 1,000 years more advanced than us, with this totally different cultural history and this completely different take on reality. So this came to me in the space of about 15 seconds. And more details have flowed in. And I use it mostly as a meditational device because it's so interesting to ask to be told about how this other civilization developed. It's amazing exoticism. You know, it's Neoplatonism, it's Taoism, it's Mayan influences melded into a completely different kind of civilization than the one that we inherited. I've always thought, you know, that Christianity, without making any judgment about Christ himself, that Christianity is hands down the single most reactionary force in all of human history. And where would we be had that 1,200 years not been given over to this peculiar meditation, you know? All the pieces were in place for the kind of civilization that I've outlined. It was just a coincidence. Kat does not endorse this idea or even encourage it.
He only told it to me a couple of days ago in Apache Junction in a truck stop or something. You know, and he didn't tell me it as the plot for a science fiction novel. He said, this is the truth. And then I said, let's get back to it being a good science fiction novel.
Well, the thing is that it would, on our level, explain perhaps the questions you were asking earlier of why the teaching plans.
Sure.
Yeah.
Another thing I was curious while you were talking about this is the physics of nowadays. You know, it's like if you have an electron on one side of the universe and split it into two and separate them by the universe, they're still in communication with each other. So is that why, logically, you can bring the time island back together again?
Yeah, this would be a quantum mechanical super macrophysical Bell's theorem event, a kind of hyperdimensional vacuum fluctuation where the two worlds spring apart, sail along for a period, and then parity is conserved and they're rejoined.
Well, this is interesting. I've had dreams that are parallel what
dreams
you're describing
really
here,
like
and
that.
It's very interesting that you bring this up. I've not heard of it before. And another thing I was curious is, like, this takes place in, this would be on a human experience level, what you're speaking of. Now, the plant kingdom, would they remain in connection between the species?
We're free to have it any way we like.
So it's, how has Christianity possibly affected the evolution of plant species in this time stream, opposed to the other? Have they gone on varying?
How does our lack of, say, 100,000 or million species in the last 200 years that the other planet has, how does that affect the parity between the two?
You mean how does our destruction and contort...
Exactly.
Well, the part of the myth that I didn't tell you, which I will now tell you, was that naturally, well, they were developing and exploring technical options many hundreds of years ago, and they discovered the theoretics for nuclear fusion and fission, but they never used it until... A few hundred years later, one of their great theoreticians, this was after they had discovered our time stream, made the prediction that the physics of atomic explosions were such that they would cross the time stream. And so they performed an experiment by detonating an atomic device in what is our year 1907. And this was the Tunguska event. And then by monitoring the dreams of Siberian shaman, which they had in clear focus, they saw, aha, this explosion which we set off actually did occur in both time streams. And at that point, they became very interested in monitoring our time stream because they were picking up the dreams of a Swiss telegraph worker who seemed to be pushing toward an unimaginable conclusion. So now there is a certain amount of urgency because if we explode our atomic stockpiles, it will wreck the place that they call homeworld.
Utter.
Yes. Yes. not self-preservation, because they now have star flight and encompass many systems, but preservation of home world, which on the other side is a vast botanical and ecological preserve from pole to pole. I mean, it's a sacred site of pilgrimage. It's the home of the species. It's the earth. And the notion that suddenly great parts of it will be blown apart by leakage from hyperspace of one of our atomic wars is impelling them now to attempt to open the doorway and rejoin the time streams, and we'll be allowed a few years inside the botanical park to acclimate, and then most people will ship off for the stars, I imagine. The British science fiction writer Ian Watson has a wonderful book called Chekhov's Journey, in which he talks about the Tunguska event, and his theory is that it was a catastrophic failure of a Soviet time travel experiment conducted shortly after the turn of the next century.
Tough one to prove, right?
Obviously. Why didn't we think of that? Well, I mean, I'm not sure. I've thought of that before. You know, it's the claim of Christian theologians that Christ comes in the center of history. They speak this same language. Before Christ, no souls were entering heaven. He freed the valve, and now it's possible to enter into heaven. Before his intercession, that was impossible. You're right, but that's where I left them, was pre-Vatican II. Before I had this idea, I had another idea, which I'll tell you, which is a completely different kind of idea. And it's the idea that there is an overmind. This doesn't involve other dimensions. There is an overmind co-present on this planet. And when the development of technology exceeds the development of ethics, then this overmind can work miracles. And because the overmind is plugged into each of the individual minds that compose it, this miracle always has this unbelievably creepy quality of being exactly the thing which would convince you to change your mind. I mean, in other words, it's like it reads you so perfectly that it's able to present the one situation which you cannot refuse. So in the case of Rome, it was that, you know, Rome was a pigsty. Pasternak called it a bargain basement on two floors. It ran on slavery, and it ran on brutality and captive populations and an outrageous garrisoning of military power in foreign lands. And people like Diophantus, this mathematician I mentioned, and Hero of Alexandria, these people were on the brink of the calculus and the steam engine. So the overmind, seeing that and seeing their appalling ethical state, sent the miraculous personage of Christ, who, in a world where information could not move faster than a horse's gallop, this religion, within 60 years, was beating at the gates of Rome itself. It was like a fire, you know, just burned through the empire and changed everything and halted technical advance, and everything stopped. Now, I created this idea in an effort to explain the UFOs, because, you know, the new theory of UFOs, or the new school of UFOs, says we've been wrong to ask what are they. That has not been fruitful. What we should be doing is asking what are they doing. And we can analyze what they're doing in the same way that we can analyze what anybody is doing through sociological polling of human populations. We can find out what the flying saucers are doing. So they polled human populations, and what they discovered is that what the flying saucers are doing is they are sowing disbelief in science. They cause people to not believe in scientists, because scientists come up so lame. when asked to explain flying saucers. It's like the flying saucer is the confounding of science in the same way that the resurrection was the complete confounding of Greek Stoicism and Democritean materialism in the Roman world. And it's conceivable, you know, that the flying saucer, I mean, the statistics are now something like 11% of the American population have seen a flying saucer, 52% believe flying saucers are real, whatever that may mean, and so forth. So it is a faith which is percolating up from the lower levels. It's people who live in trailer courts and read Fate magazine who are the staunchest believers in this thing. But what it may be is an intercession on the part of the Overmind, which it can do anything. It can do anything from our point of view. And in the most extreme version of this idea, I said, what if enormous spacecraft were to fall into orbit around this planet? And what if television images of this craft were to be beamed into every home on the planet? And then a teaching revealed some completely mind-boggling thing which you could have thought of it yourself, but you never did, which is always how these things are. And then after 30 days of melting the nuclear arsenals and causing all cancer to appear and curing all infectious diseases and delivering this message, the enormous spacecraft disappeared. 30 days. So then everybody says, my God, we have been abandoned. We have been abandoned again into time. And, you know, history would halt. Everybody would do nothing but study the teachings of the saucer and try and figure out how we could get right with them to get them to come back. Dogmatism, theories of communication, mm-hmm. priestcraft, the whole thing. So, you see, though I'm fascinated by the flying saucer and what it says about the malleability of mind and matter, I think mature civilizations should not be haunted by messiahs or flying saucers, that these things are like metaphysical spankings imposed from on high that are designed, saying, you know, here it's a boot in the tail. Wake up, you know, stop repressing.
Well, let's take your two ideas. It's neither one of them is that old. And what does the Overmind have to do with or think of the double time stream?
Well, now that's a question I never would have asked. You mean if that's true? I sort of think of these as mutually exclusive.
Well, his two theories, the earlier one was that the Overmind was injecting forces of change or conservatism into the world. The other, that events that came from, now that was from the Demiurge. Is mm-hmm. Demiurge related to the Overmind?
No, I think the Demiurge is like a negative expression of
but
the
But created
Overmind.
The universe? How did the Overmind get in there to be running the Earth, at least?
Well, I think of the Overmind as the Logos, you know. It's the understanding and self-existence which permeates everything. And the Demiurge is the force of matter and time and cosmic destiny that is always trying to lock in the Logos and condition it and make it subject to the rules of the physical universe of space and time. And the Logos is like something from... This is all Gnostic theology, by the way. This is just straight from the book. The Logos is trying to struggle through the labyrinth of the material universe to escape, to rejoin the real source of itself, which is outside of matter. Matter is viewed as an entrapment. If any of you have read the late works of Philip K. Dick, he was probing in these areas. He was a genius. His book, Velus, is pure exegesis of his internal unravelment of what was going on. And he believed, his take on it was, he believed that from A.D. 69 until 1948, no time had actually passed, and that we were living in apostolic time. and that the crucifixion lay only 75 years in the past, and that the Demiurge had inserted a false history, and the Nag Hammadi manuscripts, he believed, were actually the Logos as printed letters, and that when the Nag Hammadi manuscripts were deciphered, it was like this informational creature would come alive and again be present on the earth, that the Logos, beginning in 1948, was beginning to infuse everything, and that shortly it would dissolve the illusion of the intervening 1860 years or whatever it was, and then we would realize that the prophecy would be fulfilled and that the last days were upon us. That's right. That's right. He didn't get around to the Antichrist, to his credit, probably. You have to distinguish between Christ, the person, the teacher, and this thing called the Christos, which is this archetype of such power and force that immediately people of ill intent could get lined up behind it and impose their will. Yeah, sell love and sell forgiveness, and what a scam. And the Christos is the thing. History is ruled by the archetypes which people can generate. I mean, most people are very ordinary. I mean, your Mick Jaggers and your Henry Kissingers, they're very ordinary people, but they are able to project an archetype, you know, and that is the thing which sets them apart. And when that reaches the kind of super intense focus that you get in a Mohammed or a Christ, well then, you know, history is just putty in the hands of the force, not the person. The person is usually martyred in some horrible way, but the archetype draws energy to itself, and we don't understand how this process works. If there ever is developed by benevolent or malevolent forces a science of social control, it will be a science of knowing how to project archetypes different archetypes apparently are suitable to different times. I mean, you could almost posit an astrological theory of archetypes, but it's something about how, you know, what's appropriate for the first century AD is not appropriate for the 15th. But when the archetype is appropriate, nothing can stop it. What the modern term for archetypes is paradigm, and we expect it not to be a person, not a messiah, but an idea which will save us all, and which then gives us certain affinities with mystical Judaism, where the messiah was expected in the form of an idea. And this is sort of our faith. We're messianic ideologues or something like that. No, I agree with you. I think ultimately all dualisms have to be dissolved in the notion that, you know, there is one thing. I mean, that's the Platonic faith. The problem is all these secondary and tertiary operational levels where, you know, we're trying to actually operate in a universe of scarcity, in a body which requires energy and all these things. This is really the central problem in Western thinking, I think, is the tension between dualism and unity and matter and spirit, and how do you handle it? I think, you know, that we are spiritualizing matter. This is what technology is, and that the spiritualizing of matter is the highest expression of our technological output, and that this will become more and more what we are about, so that in the next century the difference between mind and brain and cell and machine will all have been subsumed under a new vocabulary, because we are hardwiring our minds and we are making the artifacts of our culture intelligent, and we are breaking down the barriers between ourselves and larger data bases and this kind of thing, so that the old I'm an ego inside a skin definition gives way to some kind of much more malleable and plastic thing.
Well, as an astrologer, one of the images that I like is the symbol for Pisces, which is two lines with a line going through it, and it's the definition of relationship quality by opposition. It's polarity, it's right, wrong, good, bad, male, female, Russians, Americans. The Aquarian one, which is the two lines of waves over each other, is one of resonance, and it's one of dolphins jumping in the water together. It's one of people coming together and realizing, like, how I resonate with you and what I have to give you and you have to give me, but you'll have something to give me that other people can't, and so on, and we need to swim together. And that breaks down all of the dualist bonds that, and I think we're right at that crux right at the moment, and that place between Pisces and Aquarius, where we're kind of two worlds again, flipping from one side to the other of opposition, being torn from life and death, and seeing as the Christ, I feel, was that prototype, that template of light and spirit with matter coming together and saying, I can dance in this and I can leave it and I can come back into it. I have this power. It's my conscious, compassionate love that is just so unbounded that it gives me the opportunity to play in clay if I choose.
Much of what I say is Alfred North Whitehead, his philosophy, and believe me, if you're looking around for a serious ontological foundation, you don't have to read Sanskrit. Alfred North Whitehead will serve very admirably. Science in the modern world, process and reality. He was, and remains the great psychedelic philosopher of the 20th century in the era of Bergson. You had another question.
Well, yeah, I'm going to be 84 in the year 2012, and I'm wondering how best to manage my life so that I'll be ready for that. I'm Crescent.
Well, I don't know. I think that the canyons of the Creod down which we are, as individuals are moving, those walls are getting higher and higher too. A lot of times when I had these intense contacts with the teaching entity, I would have an anxiety about what should I do? What is it for me to do? And it always said, nothing. Relax. You know, your function is to just, you'll be present where you're necessary.
Oh.
And I really, this isn't a fatalism, this is a kind of recognition of the dynamics of time that the thing is trying to teach, you see. It's trying to say that if you understand how process works, you will always understand where you are in any given process, and then you won't have anxiety about not occupying some other point in that process, you know. But when I began having these ideas, the only way I could previously relate to the notion of the end of the world was that I had a head full of cartoons of bearded men in sandals carrying signs on street corners saying, repent, repent. And here was I, you know, former Marxist, former this, former that, espousing these unimaginable things. But it's always good to do your homework. And I discovered there's a wonderful book called The Pursuit of the Millennium by Norman Cohn, in which he details the history of millenarianism. That's what this phenomenon is. The belief by a person or a group of people that the end of the world is about to occur. And it existed among the Jews of the post-exilic period. It's part of the phenomenon, or it's part of the social expectation that gave Christ his entree. The early patristic Christians lived in the imminent expectation of the end of the world. And then during the medieval period, the most utopian, prophetistic, millenarian movement before Marxism was Floraism, or the people who followed the teachings of Joaquin of Flora, who was wandering monk who predicted the end of the world. I think for 1244, and he died in 1222. But his followers carried on, and the Pope had to send out armies to quell uprisings as people wanted to distribute the wealth because they felt the end of the world was upon, and why should anybody go to work, and this sort of thing. Similarly, in the year 1000, there was great expectation of Christ's imminent return. So this is a thing which the human mind, at least in its Western expression, seems to seek to do. Islam, too, has its apocalypses. 1967 wasn't bad. I mean, I thought it was happening. I thought we were months away from a new secular order for the ages. But my theory of history views these things not as evidence against such a thing occurring, but as evidence that it will occur, that these uprisings and outbreaks of irrational expectation of the millennium are, in fact, temporal reflections. They are catching the light on the temporal prism from the object at the end of history, which contains the apocalyptic scenario. It's very important to manage the apocalypse and the millennium. It's very important that people not confuse the cleansing flames of transcendence with the ability to use thermonuclear weapons against your ideological enemies. It's a very delicate matter because our mythologies and our fears run so deeply. But I think that it's an awareness of this potential, of the existence of this law of temporal compression. And of course, institutions don't promote millenarianism because institutions want people to invest their money at low interest and long term and have the expectation that everything will carry on pretty much as it has. But an examination of the last 500 or 1,000 years of human history would lead anyone, I think, to the conclusion that everything is going to be swept away, and everything that replaces it is going to be swept away, and that we are just moving into an era of change which might as well be called apocalyptic and must be made millenarian. Otherwise, it will just end in some kind of Götterdämmerung, and the worst boogeymen of Western culture will emerge and destroy us. Yeah.
I know how the wave all comes together and accelerates toward this transition point. I never call it the end, because then the beginning of a new series of many leveled waves is there, right? I mean, this is...
That's right.
I guess I believe in flux. And so the whole process is one wave. At that moment, we begin another process. Sometimes you discuss that point as being the end of the universe, which you did a little while ago. And sometimes I feel like when you're as close, when everything is accelerated like it seems to have recently, and you're as close to a moment of transformation of some sort as we seem to be, you see great strides forward being made and great slips backwards being made all at the same time, right? It seems possible that the transformation will be not so fantastically physical as the end of the universe or the turning inside out of the whatever this is, but actually just a sweep through, you know, worldwide peace of mind. What if that occurred, you know? And that's large enough to qualify, it seems to me, for the changeover in the wave.
Yeah, I think it's very, the hardest thing to know is the nature of what this ultimate compression is.
The scale.
What it means. I mean, it, like, one way I imagine it, and that's why I love to quote Joyce about man becomes dirigible. I imagine it as the day when your mind becomes your home. You know, and all over the world, people just realize that now their mind is their home.
But this, you feel free to describe that as as the end of history or the end of the universe?
Not the end of the universe, the end of history, because I think history is some kind of involvement with matter. It's a wrestling with the angel of matter, and the end of history is when you pin the angel of matter to the mat, and then you stand up, and you say, I am the Adamic human being made of light, and you leave the realm of matter and return to some previously hidden dimension. Whitehead called these things epochs, these long periods of time, and he called transitions from one to the other a shift of epochs. Well, we've only been doing things like measuring the speed of light since 1910 or something like that. All the so-called constants of our physics are based on minuscule periods of actually monitoring these things to see if they are constants. And so I can imagine it as a shift in the laws of the universe that somehow cause consciousness to perceive itself more as it must truly be. And I'm always trying to find physical models for these transcendental hallucinations. And the one which fits this is a few years ago, Scandinavian astronomer Hans Alfven wrote a book called Worlds and Anti-Worlds, and in it he talked about what's called a vacuum fluctuation. A vacuum fluctuation is where suddenly, out of nothingness, there emerge a stream of particles, and they are equally particles and antiparticles, and they sail along for a period of time, and then they collide again, and each particle is destroyed by its antiparticle, and so what is called parity is conserved, meaning that when you add up all the charges, positive and negative, you get zero. So it's okay that this matter came from nothing and returned to nothing. This violates no laws as long as parity is conserved. But the interesting thing about this phenomenon, which is called a vacuum fluctuation, is that there seems in quantum mechanics no rule which would limit the size of such a phenomenon as this. So it's conceivable that our entire universe is an enormous vacuum fluctuation, and it's just, you know, 10 high 72 particles have emerged from nothingness and are hurtling through space. And in another dimension, a parallel dimension, the anti-universe, which is the twin of this universe, is also hurtling through space. And at some point in future time, completely unpredictable from the state given within each universe, the two will collide. And and parity will be conserved. And all particles and antiparticles will disappear. However, the interesting thing is that photons, which is what light is composed of, do not have antiparticles. They're this one weird exception. So that when the universe collided with its antimatter twin, what would be left would be a universe made only of photons. And those photons would be in the configuration they were in the moment when the cosmic collapse of the state vector occurred. Well, we have no idea what the physics of a photonic universe would be about. A limiting case or a good first try would be that it would just be nothing and no life and no self-reflection and no but why posit that? There's such a persistence in the perennial philosophy of the notion that spiritual development is somehow related to light and to the cultivation of inner light and to the creation of light bodies and the stabilizing of light. So, you know, it's possible to suggest that the world of the imagination is simply the world of internal light, that it's a world where light is manipulated by thought in the way that in this world physical organism manipulates matter, and so that, you know, you live in the radiant castles of the imagination after a shift of epochs in which the the photonic mode predominated. That's just one way of imagining it. It's one of the richest meditations there is, to try to imagine the millennium. Again, it's this thing, what would you have if you could have anything? I mean, sometimes I imagine it, you know, Hieronymus Bosch's great triptych, The Garden of Earthly Delights, where men and women of all races mingle among giant wrens and strawberries and feed each other pomegranates under an autumnal sun in an endless rolling park-like world of exotic vegetables and sexual excess and hard stuff to be.
Sounds better than the end of the universe.
You can really take a readout on yourself by seeing how would you like things to be. You know, I mean, I have sometimes my fantasy is I would like to be alone on a starship 10,000 light years from home with all the books in the universe, and I would dress like Captain Ahab, and I would stride around the catwalks inside this echoing starship, and faithful robot slaves would bring me crumbling volumes of ancient lore, which I would, you know, say, no, this is a little too Vincent Price. How about... I love, if any of you are into science fiction, the science fiction of Cordwainer Smith is really wonderful. And one of his stories, The Starship, is George Washington's estate, Mount Vernon, in New York. And it's all exactly like Mount Vernon in Washington's time, except in the library of the big plantation house, there's one room from which the thing is controlled, and it's actually a starship in mid-flight. More questions about this time theory? Or
yes, I have a question.
Yes.
You mentioned here how the now is flooded with future perception.
Yes.
And I have just, it's really part of the Tibetan practices, but it's always something which captures my imagination. It's just, how come it's now? And the fact that these future perceptions are so tremendously tangible to us, especially while sitting in meditation or while eating a meal even or something, and there's this, how come it's not yesterday, and how come it's not tomorrow, and how come that I'm here now when I just have to flick my mind and I'm in yesterday and equally easy in tomorrow? I wonder if you have anything to say on that one.
Well, I think that life proceeds through time. It's an effort by organism to map something one dimension larger than itself. So it takes a whole life to do it. A life is an effort to map a something, you know? And the now is the moving edge of the mapping process. You cannot map it instantly or you would be it. And so what being in time is experiencing the incremental mapping of this higher order object. And that's why hopefully a long life would give wisdom, because a person would begin to get the whole picture.
Hmm.
You know?
So the now is kind of like the edge of the pencil as it
moves
over the ground.
The
yes, well, what did Plato say? That the present is the moving image of eternity. That's pure good Platonism.
Like a projection, much as our shadows are two-dimensional.
Well, you can think of it as you can think of the now as a kind of laser which is moving over a larger surface and illuminating it, you know, scanning it. It's scanning something, and it takes it a while to scan it, and then at the end all the data is in place, and then you say, oh yes, I see now what the object of cognition was. And our faith is, and there's no reason to doubt it, that this is a great transcendent experience. This is the resolution, the peace that passeth understanding as you sink into death. It's just that we like to think that the psychedelic experience gives us a preview. No one escapes, you know, the final realization. It's just...